Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the early 2000s, only a few countries had the technology to produce unmanned aerial vehicles for military purposes and used them in combat. Some, like the US, enjoyed a near monopoly on this technology back then. Americans boasted about their advanced drones such as the Reaper and Global Hawk that carried a price tag of millions of dollars. However, this monopoly no longer exists, as many countries have managed to develop their own drone programs in recent years to a stage that enables them to produce and even export UAVs. One of the countries that has made great strides in this field is Iran. Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 and the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq War a year after, Tehran understood the need for developing new defensive and deterrent capabilities. And this gave birth to Iran's drone program. While since the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has been the target of harsh sanctions, it began producing drones by relying on its domestic potential, particularly the knowledge of the youth. The result, an absolute technological triumph for the Islamic Republic. Now Iran produces drones with the ability to deliver precision-guided missiles in a whopping range of 2,000 kilometers, besides flight endurance of over 24 hours and stealth capabilities. Iranian drones also have a wide diversity and are among the best and most efficient in the world and can perform missions in various fields. The main superiority of Iranian drones compared to foreign models is that they are cheap, have more range and flight endurance, they have stealth capabilities, and counter GPS jamming systems. Iranian officials say these reasons have attracted many customers in many countries to buy drones from Iran.
Iran is now self-sufficient in equipping its armed forces with homegrown systems. Since the onset of the Islamic Revolution, maintaining military readiness with a defensive approach for stable security and deterrence has been a definite and practical policy of Iran. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Pakistan has held a parliamentary elections to choose the new prime minister and members of the country's parliament along with four provincial assemblies. The polling, which started at 8 in the morning, continued until 5 in the evening without any break. Over 128 million registered voters across the country cast their ballots for a record 17,816 candidates of both national and provincial assembly seats.
Elections in Pakistan are absolutely crucial, especially during times of economic crisis. As a nation, we are grappling with significant economic challenges, and it's through the electoral process that we have the opportunity to bring about change.
By casting our votes, we can choose leaders who have the vision, capability, and dedication to implement policies that will lead to economic recovery and prosperity.
At least 12 people, including 10 security officials, were killed in separate incidents of violence, while the internet and mobile phone services remained suspended on election day.
Preliminary election results indicate that independent candidates backed by Imran Khan's PTI party managed to secure victory. However, Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, is anticipated to be a contender for a fourth term. Three times Pakistan's former prime minister Nawaz Sharif says that he is ready to serve the nation for the fourth time if elected.
We will try our best to overcome the challenges we are facing at the moment. We will provide relief to the masses at their doorsteps as we have promised during our election campaign. My party will also combat inflation.
Nawaz Sharif's political rival, ex-premier Imran Khan, who was overthrown by his opponents through a vote of no confidence in April 2022, is still behind bars for several convictions and is not allowed to run for office against his competitors. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Music. The ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Syria, Dr. Hussein Akbari, held a press conference on Thursday at the Iranian embassy in Damascus for the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He discussed Iran's achievements in the past 45 years and its positions at regional and international levels.
As you know, we're currently commemorating the 45th anniversary of the glorious Islamic Revolution. This revolution emerged victorious under exceptional circumstances and stood against the two main ideologies of that time, imperialism and communism. The revolution presented a new discourse and enabled Iran to break free from Western American hegemony, refusing to submit to any other form of domination. Consequently, a global threat was formed against Iran.
Akbari highlighted the principles of the revolution on Iran's foreign policy to support justice and equality around the world. This put Iran under enormous pressure. Answering journalists' questions, he stressed that Tehran and Damascus share the same principles in supporting resistance against oppression.
The Islamic Revolution has been based on modern foundations and principles since its inception. Its initial slogans were that the Islamic Republic is neither Eastern nor Western. The second slogan focused on the liberation of the Palestinian people from Zionist occupation and the liberation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Islamic Republic remained committed to the slogan, despite its high costs. No one stood beside the Islamic Revolution in Iran or supported it except for Syria, who believed that resistance is the right of all people.
The Iranian ambassador affirmed that no matter the pressures, the Islamic Republic will never change its principles and will always support the resistance movement until victory over the occupation. The Arab Writers Union also held a forum that highlighted the achievements and impacts of the Islamic Revolution, not only in Iran, but also at the regional and international levels. The participants talked about how the Islamic Revolution has solidified the culture of resistance as well as fighting for the liberation of all nations. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
It was vindication on all counts. In one of the most closely monitored employment tribunal cases of recent memory, Professor David Miller and his legal team successfully claimed unfair dismissal and discrimination based on his philosophical belief that Zionism is inherently racist, imperialist, and colonial. In a high-profile case, Professor Miller was dismissed by Bristol University in October 2021 after a campaign of relentless harassment by pro-Zionists.
So what it means is that, first of all, I was wrongfully dismissed by the university. They didn't properly investigate the complaints against me, and they didn't properly evaluate what they should do with the results of that investigation. Second of all, the court determined that my anti-Zionist views are protected under law, and it's illegal to discriminate against someone who has anti-Zionist views. And they determined that the university had, contrary to what they said, actually dismissed me because of my anti-Zionist views. So that was the key finding. And of course, that's a protection going forward for every person in the UK in employment who is attacked by their employer or by the Zionist movement, that they cannot be sacked for having anti-Zionist views.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson.
Former parliamentarian Chris Williamson, himself a victim of pro-Zionist hounding, responded to the verdict.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted for David personally, but this is a landmark case and will cause huge ramifications, I think, for other people who have been targeted by the Zionist lobby. And many people have been threatened with their employment. Others have lost employment as a result of their support for the Palestinian people. And so now we've got it established in law that opposition to Zionism is a protected characteristic under the Equalities Act.
A statement from the lawyers representing Professor Miller in this case reads, in part,
"This is a landmark case and marks a pivotal moment in the history of our country for those who believe in upholding the rights of Palestinians. The timing of this judgment will be welcomed by many who at present are facing persecution at their workplaces for speaking out against the Israeli crime."
In the face of the unrelenting genocide taking place in Gaza, pro-Palestinian voices are under increased pressure to remain silent. Professor Miller's victory could make workplaces safer for Palestinian advocates.
The position we were in was I made what are fairly unexceptional anti-Zionist points in my public comments. Now, to Zionist ears, these are unconscionable, outrageous things to say. Zionism is racism, Zionism is colonial, Zionism will always be racist. And the Zionists don't like that, and so they want to show that that is somehow anti-Semitism or some kind of slur on Jewish people. And of course, it's not, but that's what they wanted to show. But what the court has determined is that those unexceptional anti-Zionist statements are, in fact, unexceptional anti-Zionist statements, and that everybody can make those kinds of statements without fear.
Professor Miller's staunch pro-Palestinian views, including his work here on Palestine Declassified, made him a target for the pro-Zionist mob. Now, perhaps his victory at tribunal level will serve as an inspiration for those hoping to raise their voices for Palestine. And how is it really? Professor Miller's legal team will now be seeking the maximum compensation on offer for the losses and hurt caused by the discrimination suffered. Amina Taylor, London.
In response to recent US and UK airstrikes against Yemen, the country's armed forces have carried out a naval operation targeting American and British vessels.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out two military operations in the Red Sea, the first targeting an American ship, Star Nasia, and the other targeting a British ship, Morning Tide. Both ships were targeted with appropriate naval missiles, and the hits were accurate and direct.
Sari added the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more qualitative military operations against all hostile American and British targets in the Red and Arab Seas. He said Sana'a reserves the right to respond to the US-UK aggression against Yemen. Military experts said this operation proves that the Yemeni army is capable of handling more than one target simultaneously. They added that the targeted vessels were carrying military equipment to Israel.
This is the first military operation in which we target two ships at the same time, an American and a British one. And this is to confirm our ability to deal with more than one target simultaneously. And any attempt by the enemy to camouflage its ships at sea will fail. We can identify its ship. Both ships or one of them were carrying military equipment heading to the ports of occupied Palestine to support the Israeli enemy.
Recently, the US and UK have intensified their strikes against Yemen, specifically targeting residential areas in Hodeidah City in a failed attempt to undermine the Yemeni army's capabilities and halt Yemen's naval operations. The Yemeni army has repeatedly affirmed that it will only cease its operations when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza.
Despite the continued attacks on Yemen by the US and UK, Yemen's army is expanding its naval operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, indicating that Western aggression has failed to affect the Yemeni army's capabilities. It has also vowed to confront Western escalation with broader operations targeting their interests in the region. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Muslim women and girls have held a conference on hijab, claiming that women are still persecuted and discriminated against for having hijab in the country. This is despite a Supreme Court ruling which established the use of hijab as a fundamental human right. One of the speakers at the conference explained that wearing the hijab is a religious obligation for Muslim women who have been directed to cover their bodies. She said it is therefore unacceptable for any discrimination against women on account of having hijab.
Sometimes the non-Muslims see hijab as a kind of barrier or as a kind of something that is anti-national development, feeling that Muslims are trying to show that they are Muslim is exclusive. But the truth of the matter, we all know that what we are trying to protect is the morality of the society. So the moment a lady wears hijab, it means she's being protected from the predatory eyes of the men.
The Coalition of Nigerian Muslim Women also staged an outreach in a park in Abuja where they engaged both Muslims and Christians, explaining the benefits of the hijab. Many women and girls were offered free pieces of headscarf, veils, and were taught how to tie them.
In a public park, you have different set of people, different faith, and different characters. So we feel that Islam is a religion for the universe, and then we need to share with everybody. And then this hijab being a very controversial issue in Nigeria, especially in our institution of higher learning and even in some few government establishments, we feel that we need to be here.
The group of Muslim women have insisted that everyone should understand that the hijab emphasizes the dignity, confidence, modesty, protection, and respect for females. They said the hijab is neither a symbol of the oppression of women nor an act of defiance against non-Muslims, and called on all Nigerians nursing this erroneous perception to stop in the interest of peaceful coexistence and respect for the law. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Scientists working with special electron microscopes in order to undertake cutting-edge research and product development. This is nanotechnology, the integration of science and engineering on a tiny scale, namely with atoms and molecules. A relatively new field of science and technology with perceived long-term benefits, one that Iran has taken very seriously and today is reaping its rewards. This is all in line with long-term goals and 3-10-year plans to develop nanotechnology in Iran, with leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's full support.
ارزش داره از این جهت نمونه ایست که ما بدانیم در همه کارهای کشور از این نمونه تبعیت کنیم و از این معیار قرار بدیم از این جهت هم برای ما ارزش داره.
But that is not enough. The main strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is to benefit from this cutting-edge technology. Therefore, according to officials at the Nanotechnology Development Headquarters, commercializing nano products is an important step and a top priority.
In 2001, which is pretty much the same time that other countries began to engage in nanotechnology development, we established a nanotech headquarters, and in many universities and research centers across the country, scientists started doing research in this field. We started with fewer than 10 scientists, but today there are more than 40,000 researchers and university professors working in this field in more than 150 nanotechnology research centers across the country.
Let me give you some statistics in order to explain what we mean by prioritizing. Right now, as we speak, we have commercialized 1,800 nanoproducts. More than 350 manufacturers have received nanotechnology production permits, and many laboratories are now equipped with or use nanotech devices and products. But the bad news is, in 2022, we sold over $1 billion worth of nanoproducts, and we earned $70 million from exports. Currently, 47 countries, including regional countries such as Iraq and Turkey, import nanoproducts made in Iran.
Advancements in a relatively new field of science such as nanotechnology is only one of the many achievements Iran has made after the Islamic Revolution, and definitely one that every single Iranian is proud of.
Over the past two decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to gain a firm foothold in nanotechnology, today ranking among the world's top five in the field. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. More than 4 months has passed since Israel started its onslaught against the people of the Gaza Strip. Nearly 28,000 Palestinians have lost their lives and about 70,000 others have been injured. Most of the population in the besieged territory have been forced to move to the southern city of Rafah. Now Israel is preparing to invade the Palestinians' last refuge in the Gaza Strip. The United Nations has warned of a bloodbath if Israel invades the city. Where else do the Palestinians have to go? And will there ever be an end to the decades-long Western-backed occupation and genocide against the Palestinian people? Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. And also we have radio host and journalist at CPR News, Mr. Don DeBar, joining us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. McGovern. After 126 days of Israeli barbarism and brutality, nearly 29,000 people have been killed in Gaza. Schools, mosques, churches, hospitals, and even ambulances have been frequent targets of the strikes, which have now left only a few of the medical facilities partially operational in Gaza. Please share with us your perspective on this tragedy that is unfolding in Gaza before our very eyes.
Well, the painful thing, of course, is that I'm an American citizen, and without the support of my government, Israel could not do these things. Not only is it arming and giving political support to Israel, but it's also denying the requisite funding for the only agency that can help, and that's UNRWA, the UN body that provides aid to the people in Gaza and has for many, many years. They have decided to withhold funding on the pretext that some, well, first they said 12, now it's down to 6 of the 26,000 employees of UNRWA in Gaza were cooperating or somehow involved with Hamas. They said that without providing any evidence, and our Secretary of State bought it, saying, you know, I think this is completely plausible, even though we don't have any confirmation. So what pains me is the fact that this could stop, and we're trying to exert pressure on our government to stop enabling this. So far, we have not been successful.
Don DeBar, after over 4 months of lethal and deadly attacks, the resistance groups in Gaza are fighting back strong, both inside and outside of the strip. Iran's foreign minister has recently highlighted that Israel has achieved none of its goals after 4 months of genocide in Gaza. So what have the Israelis achieved, other than being record holders for murdering children?
Well, whatever political constituency existed in the world, whatever pockets in the world, some large pockets in the United States and Western Europe, of support for Israel has, you know, pretty much evaporated. It is very difficult to explain what people have been witnessing now for the last 4 months in any terms other than mass murder or genocide or whatever. The people that don't want to get bogged down in legal definition of genocide, does this rise to this or that level? Look at the murder of thousands of civilians, including thousands of children, and understand that that's wrong no matter what it's called. We're sitting in the United States. It's really almost head-splitting confusing. There was a trial that concluded yesterday in the Midwestern part of the United States. I don't remember if it was Michigan or Ohio, of a woman whose 15-year-old son had taken a gun to school and killed 4 fellow students. She was convicted also of homicide, of involuntary manslaughter, based on criminal negligence, basically, that this is her child did this, and so she's culpable, basically, for not educating him better, keeping better rein on him, and allowing him to have a gun. this case was being raised by people who in the United States who believe that guns kill people, not people kill people. And then we look at a place like Israel or Ukraine, where there are people that claim not to be the United States, either making war on Russia or committing genocide on the Palestinians. The U.S. claims that that's not them and they're not culpable for it. And the weapons sales, you know, the United States has an $850-900 billion a year budget, basically producing things that murder people in large numbers. So it's difficult to parse which is which. Rifles that kids can use to shoot 10 of their friends, or bombs that blow up entire cities, you know, in the course of a week or two. But we have people making money on both of them, by the way, and both will continue until we stop it.
Ray McGovern, the UN Chief Antonio Guterres says a ceasefire is needed before, quote, a gigantic tragedy develops in Rafah. Now, Israel, as we mentioned earlier, is bombing areas of Gaza it had initially designated as safe, with it wiping out entire families, and it's now planning a ground assault in Rafah. Is Israel using the excuse of eradicating Hamas, something that it has failed to achieve, to continue to kill Palestinians? A senior Hamas official says the Israeli Prime Minister's insistence on continuing the onslaught against Gaza shows his goal is genocide against Palestinians.
What the Israeli Defense Minister said very early on in the first week of their retaliation was that we're dealing with human animals here. We have to pretty much exterminate them, as many other Israeli leaders have said. Now, for genocide, you have to prove intent. And so it was no problem for the International Court of Justice to prove intent based on the pronouncements of the Israeli leaders themselves and these troops that followed their orders. So, it really needs to stop. And for the UN Secretary General to say, oh my, this will be a bloodbath that we never seen before in my tenure, that's not enough, okay? Now, what's enough? He has to lean on the United States and Great Britain, U.S. vassal, and get the president to stop what he's doing, President Biden. Even in his old age, even though the Department of Justice here in the United States has called him feeble, memory deprived, and old, they did that yesterday, they should wake him up and say, look, we need you to stop this because it's the U.S. that needs to stop it. Meanwhile, I have to say that the Houthis, strangely enough, have a real partner in their struggle to stop the genocide. And who is that partner? It happens to be a UN body called the International Court of Justice. Wow. Where are the other Arab leaders? Where are the leaders of Turkey? Who they need to explicitly condemn all this and do more than condemn it. In a gradual way. In other words, I'm not saying a major offensive or a major attack of any kind, but ape what Vladimir Putin is doing in Ukraine. Attrition, 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 until the Israelis are feeling so much economic damage from what the Houthis are doing in the Red Sea that they'll realize that they have no future. They have no economic future unless they cease and desist.
Don DeBar, in his most recent comments, U.S. President Joe Biden said the Israelis have gone, quote-unquote, over the top regarding the assault on Gaza. How far is too far in the support that Washington is offering for the Israelis and the massacre that they're committing? Iran's foreign minister just recently said the U.S. military, financial, and diplomatic support for Israel will have no result but defeat.
Well, actually, in his most recent remarks, President Biden appointed President al-Sisi as president of Mexico. That was, I think, his last public statement. too far was passed within a day of the of October 7th, maybe October 8th. Too far really had been passed somewhere in 1947, 1948. The terrorist attacks that were made against the Palestinian people in the run-up to the creation of what they call the State of Israel. You have failures across the board by the U.S. Government and its actions along with the Israelis. There's an ongoing set of violations of U.N. Security Council resolutions that are supposed to be setting the borders of Israel and Palestine at 1967. They've been ignored pretty much 50 years now by the Israelis. There have been various war crimes committed periodically by the Israelis and by extension by the United States. That's just in that conflict. Of course, the United States has been committing them all over the planet. The bombing recently of Yemen, of Syria, along with an illegal occupation of Iraq, along with an illegal occupation that still continues, even after it was officially discontinued several times now. This is, in essence, the standard operating procedure of the empire. I don't know how you put a stop to it using the architecture of imperialism that was constructed in the aftermath of World War II, but it has to be stopped by whatever means necessary. And we're getting close to the point where it has to be stopped now.
Ray McGovern, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in his recent trip to Beirut, said that Israel wants to drag the U.S. alongside itself into the West Asia quagmire. Do you believe the Israelis are seeking to expand their onslaught on Gaza into a wider regional conflict so they can get the U.S. directly involved? And are those actions producing the results that the Israelis are seeking?
Well, I have to tell you that I've been around for a while, and I know what quagmires are. I've been to Vietnam. I've been to Afghanistan. I've watched Iraq. I've watched Libya. The U.S. getting involved in quagmires? Of course. Israel and its neoconservative patriots there in the U.S. government would like nothing better than to get the U.S. involved overtly in a war against Iran. Now, that can only happen if Iran rises to the bait, so to speak, okay? Now, Iran, in my view, has played it very cautiously. It knows, as most educated observers know, that Israel is on its way out. This is never going to be the same for Israel. The problem is, what to do for the next 2 weeks? What to do when the rest of those Gazans are exterminated? A word used by the Nazis when I was a little boy, exterminated in and around Rafah and south Gaza. What to do then? That's what my concern is, because I care about the children. And as Roger Waters puts it in his song, we have to ensure that no one kills the children anymore.
Don DeBar, Yemen has pledged to continue its operations against Israeli-linked vessels until the regime stops its war on Gaza, regardless of the attacks by the U.S.-led coalition in the Red Sea. The leader of Yemen's Ansar al-Movement says the U.S.-led aggression against his country will not protect Israeli-linked ships. Talk to us about the Yemeni response to the Gaza onslaught and this defiant message that the Yemenis are sending to the U.S. and its allies.
Well, to a large degree, first of all, it's returning fire that's been levied against Yemen and Gaza for years now by, Yemen has been looking at a quarantine in JFK's terminology, a blockade, whatever, heavily sanctioned and traffic heavily controlled by external forces, as has Gaza since 2007. And they're returning fire now. They're basically saying, oh, really? Well, we're not allowing any traffic in to resupply you. Under the present conditions, the global opinion, world opinion is with them, certainly the people on the ground. You know, there's a situation that exists in the immediate area that I think is now, being replicated around the world. The sympathies of the people, forgetting the governments, but of the people throughout the Muslim and Arab worlds have always been with the Palestinians, even if the policies of their governments were not. The governments had to at least pay lip service and maintain a respectful, quote-unquote, distance from the Zionist state. And we're at a point now where the situation for the Palestinians is so desperate in front of all these other folks in the neighborhood that these governments have had to bend a little more, and still some of them are looking down the barrel of a gun called revolution if they don't do something, if they stand by and allow this to continue to happen. I think that's also developing around the world to a degree. And so Yemen suddenly getting involved like this, rather than looking like extreme or terrorism or whatever, looks appropriate to a lot of people. They're trying to stop a slaughter of a people. So I think that the Israelis and the U.S. or whoever's really making policy did a serious overreach this time. And I think that on the ground, the whole game board basically is changing, that being the mindset of the people.
Raymond Governor, let's turn our attention to the resistance outfits in Iraq and Syria. What do you think are the motives behind the United States' recent attacks on those resistance groups in Iraq and Syria?
Very simple, to show how strong the United States is. We put these poor fellows in the line of fire as targets, and then when somebody shoots at them, we're real strong. We'll retaliate. One fact that needs to be mentioned in any discussion like this is that the Houthis and Iran are not alone here. As most people don't know, a treaty between Russia and Iran is in its very final stages. And also, China is desperately interested in making sure that things don't blow up in the Persian Gulf or the Red Sea because they depend so heavily on Iranian oil. So, what does that mean? That means that Iran is not alone. This is very different constellation of forces than just 2-3 decades ago. And the problem is that our president doesn't seem to be able to understand that, and his advisors don't seem to be able to tell him that, you know, this is different. We have to stop supporting Israel 110%.
Don DeBar, Iraq has condemned the latest U.S. drone strike on the capital, Baghdad, calling it a breach of the country's sovereignty. An Iraqi resistance movement has called for submitting a request to the UN Security Council to demand the immediate withdrawal of foreign forces. The Iraqi prime minister has also stated that Baghdad wants a quick withdrawal of the destabilizing U.S. forces from Iraq. So we see the pressure keeps piling and piling on the United States, and a deadline has not been set, but still, at this point, it seems Iraqi politicians have this historic opportunity to expel the U.S. from Iraq. How close are we, in your opinion, to seeing that day?
You know, that's the kind of thing that happens all of a sudden, you know, apparently all of a sudden. It builds over, you know, a long period of time, and then there's just some catalyzing event that triggers a series of events in rapid succession. I think we're looking at that now. I mean, I can't imagine a more catalyzing event than a genocide on television for 4 months. But this is an expression of the phenomenon that I was referring to before. The Iraqi government, whether to call them a comprador government or not, I don't know, but certainly they have existed, you know, in the post-occupation period with at least the sufferance of the United States government, of the military, who are still, you know, occupying pieces of Iraq, by the way, and still operational, obviously, because they've conducted operations there, both on the ground inside and from outside into Iraq. The people in Iraq have had it. If everything that's happened since 1991 or whatever wasn't sufficient, finally, we're certainly there. And so whether the government wants to or not, they're going to have to pursue this line of antagonism and, in essence, kicking the United States out, or the people will do it for them and send them along with the U.S. troops. I think that's pretty much on the agenda now in a lot of homes in Iraq.
Ray McGovern, in reaction to the ICJ's ruling, which you also alluded to earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, he called the order a disgrace and vowed to continue the onslaught. That, of course, was to be expected because the Israelis have been a rogue entity since day one. But does this expose the lack of a proper global mechanism to deal with such issues? The tribunals are powerless. The UN Security Council has been nothing but a spectator for 4 months as hundreds of innocent people are dying daily in Gaza. How can this status quo change, in your opinion? And in a case like this, how and where can accountability start to take shape?
I concede that the UN has its limits, but it's a hell of a lot better than the international rules-based system, which has no limit and which has no jurisdiction or validity. So what I would like to do is say, look, the UN was set up at a time when we did things sensibly. I applaud the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, now the Syrians, and now the Iraqis for using the UN and the UN Security Council, which does have some teeth, in their best effort to do the right thing. Now, in the process, the U.S. is completely isolated. When it votes, it has maybe two allies, at Israel and a obscure set of islands in the Pacific Ocean that is forced to vote with the United States. So it's maybe 300 to hundreds. So this is going to work its way out. I don't rule out the UN. It's the only thing we have left. And as I say, several of the nations seem to realize that. And we need to give them a chance. The problem, of course, is what happens in the next 2 weeks, the next 2 days, to those people in Gaza.
Don DeBar, do you agree with Mr. Govan regarding the UN?
Yeah, look, the UN is not the answer to these problems, but, you know, in terms of ignoring it or walking away from it, that was tried at the very beginning of its life, at the beginning of what we call the Korean War here. The Soviet Union, rather than vetoing the War Powers Resolution or whatever the analog name is for that, walked out to boycott it, and so there was a UN force sent in on the side of the U.S. Anywhere where people are sitting down talking, and particularly in a public forum, to vet these issues is a good thing. It's more than what we have, and so I wouldn't sit around and wait for it to work, but I wouldn't walk away from it either. It's got to be a part of the whole effort.
One last question, Mr. DeBar, while we're with you. In spite of all the efforts to weaken the resistance in the region and efforts by Israel and co. to demonize it, why do you think that the resistance front is still thriving?
Well, the more you oppress people, the more incentive they have to rise up. You actually force their hand. You know, in the Star Wars movie, the Princess Leia, whatever, you know, the tighter you squeeze, the more worlds will, you know, slip through your fingers. That's how it works. We're human beings. We don't like to have somebody make us do stuff we don't want to do. We don't like to watch people kill our families. We don't like to starve when it's not necessary. We won't tolerate it at some point, and we're getting to that point around the world with this empire. This is one of the hot points where that's happening.
Mr. McGovern, same question to you.
When Osama bin Laden and his lieutenant, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, let's take Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was asked why he was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. He said, it was because of my deep hatred for U.S. policy favoring Israel against the rights of the other peoples. People have to take that seriously. That was buried in page 148 of the 9/11 report in one sentence. But if you're asking why people do these things, they get to a point where they seek vengeance for the clear affronts to their human nature that they have suffered. It's inevitable, and nobody's pointing that out, that the more we do this stuff out there in the Southwest Asia, so-called now, the more likely it is that we'll have another 9/11 or something like it.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern from Raleigh, North Carolina. And also thanks to Don DeBar, radio host and journalist, CPR News, joining us from Austin, New York. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Islamic Revolution, Independence, and Honorable Foreign Policy. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. Throughout the struggles of the Iranian people against the despotic and corrupt Pahlavi regime, two slogans were chanted very frequently. The first slogan was, Independence, Freedom, Islamic Republic. And the other one was, Neither Eastern nor Western, only Islamic rule, which has been simply translated as, Neither East nor West, Islam is the best. These two slogans were close in meaning, and they had been demanded by the entire nation. In the 10th episode of the special series, on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we are going to review various aspects of independence of Iran after the revolution in comparison with the pre-revolution era. Stay tuned, please. With the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, Iran came out of the yoke of the American dominance while rejecting dependence on then other superpower, namely Soviet Union. Keeping this principled policy granted dignity to the Iranian nation, although it has been followed by innumerable problems and obstacles ever since. Persistence in this principle of foreign policy was evidently seen in the 1980s, when the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was ordered by his masters in Washington to wage an all-out war against Iran to topple the Islamic Republic system. The invading Saddam enjoyed the support of the United States, the former Soviet Union, and all Western and Arab regimes, but the Islamic Republic didn't capitulate to the excessive and illegal demands of the Iraqi dictator and his paymasters. The Islamic Republic of Iran's foreign diplomacy is based on the luminous teachings of Islam, which have their roots in verse 141 of chapter Nisa of the Noble Quran, saying, Allah will never provide for the faithless a way of dominance over the faithful. In view of this, Imam Khomeini, who brought the Noble Quran to the scenes of everyday life and interpreted it in practice, always emphasized this principle of negation of dominance of the faithless over Muslims. In view of this, Article 152 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran explicates the principles of foreign policy as follows. The foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is based on negation of any dominance seeking and acceptance of dominance, keeping all-out independence and territorial integrity of the country.
defending the rights of all Muslims, non-aligned against domineering powers, and peaceful relations with non-aggressive governments. According to the progressive and dignified principles, the Islamic Republic will never accept or admit any foreign dominance. It will never intend to dominate or invade any country either. For the past 45 years, this policy has properly been observed. The popular Islamic system has sought to set up brotherly relations with Muslim nations, particularly with neighbors. It has also pursued relations with the countries which seek respectful relations based on mutual interests. However, the governments, which intend to impose their demands on the Iranian people, have no place in Iran's foreign diplomacy. These governments are mainly beguiled by the enemies of the Islamic Republic, especially the United States and the fabricated Zionist regime. This conduct of the Islamic Republic is based on verse 48 of chapter Fat of the Noble Quran, which reads, Muhammad, the apostle of Allah, and those with him are harsh against the faithless and affectionate with each other. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, referring to this verse, stresses, We are not in reconciliation with enemies, with the arrogance, but with Muslim brothers, we are not enemy or hostile. We rather seek friendship and brotherhood. He has based the Iranian foreign policy on three principles of dignity, wisdom, and expediency. The leader explains that dignity means negation of besieging in diplomacy and safeguarding the might and principles of the system. He explains wisdom as wise and calculated interactions and activities in foreign policy. Then he explicates expediency as follows. Expediency means to find a way for passing by hard barriers and continuing the way to reach the goal. These principles have been seriously put on the agenda, especially during the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, whose government has been successful in becoming a member of the Shanghai Economic Organization and the BRICS group. These measures have further promoted Iran's status in the regional and international arenas.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.